Welcome to A State of Readiness, a podcast set as a fireside chat with business leaders to discuss what it takes for a company to be in a state of readiness and become a high-performance organization with your host, Joseph Paris. Welcome, everyone, to the very first episode of State of Readiness, a podcast on business goings-on, leadership, designed as a fireside chat and as conversational as possible, but I want to have a repertoire of some of the best leaders in the world that I can find to have on it. And our very, very first guest is Brent Gleason, a Navy SEAL combat vet with multiple tours in Iraq and Africa. Upon leaving the SEAL Team 5, Brent turned to his discipline battlefield lessons to the world of business and has become an accomplished entrepreneur, author, acclaimed speaker on topics ranging from leadership, building high-performance teams, to culture and organizational transformation. Brent is the founder and CEO of Talking Point Leadership, a progressive leadership and management consultancy firm with a focus on business transformation and building high-performance cultures. Brent has degrees in finance and economics from Southern Methodist University, certificates in English and history from Oxford University in England, and a graduate business degree from the University of San Diego. He is a best-selling author of the book Talking Point, a Navy SEAL's 10 Fail-Safe Principles for Leading Through Change, which was a number one new release on Amazon in organizational change and business structural adjustment. Welcome, Brent. How are you doing today?
I'm great. Excited to be on the show.
Yeah, great to have you here. I've been following your goings-on on LinkedIn for quite some time, and it seems that that your book is resonating with a wide audience. I see that you're speaking almost every day someplace in the world.
Yes, it is. It's going very well. Like you mentioned, it is a bestseller, and I wrote the book for several reasons, but there's just so much dynamic disruption and change in the business world today that it's affecting every industry, almost every business, large and small. And quite frankly, when I'm asked to speak, because I've shown some thought leadership in that space and expertise through my writings and research and Forbes column and Inc. and now the book, it's just a very relevant topic. Everybody wants to talk about how to better lead through change, how to lead organizational transformation, because quite frankly, it's one of the most difficult aspects of leadership when it comes to business is leading significant change in any organization.
So what do you see as some of the major challenges facing corporations as they transform?
Well, all businesses today are forced based on emerging technology and disruptions in marketplaces. And there's organizations out there like Amazon, for example, that are disrupting spaces that you would never even think are related to consumer goods, because organizations like Amazon, it's just one example, are changing the entire perception of the consumer. We want everything now. We want it at the click of a button. We don't have to pull our credit card out. So it's affecting financial services, healthcare. Everything is changing at a faster pace than most organizations and their leaders can keep up with. So oftentimes businesses are forced to grow faster with fewer resources. Therefore, sometimes we are paying less attention to the financial strategy and more just on top line sales and growth and trying to enter new markets just to compete and stay relevant in this modern 21st century business environment. Yet, a lot of leaders and managers out there, including myself in the past, we don't necessarily know how to successfully lead change in our organizations because it's very difficult. It really touches every element of the business from top to the bottom across the organization, to culture, to engagement, to participation of the team, to maintaining high levels of morale, communicating a powerful vision. All of these things are critical to leading change. Yet, according to last year's McKinsey & Company data, 70% of organizational transformation efforts fail or at least fall short of meeting their objectives due to so many challenges in those areas. It's such a dynamic thing to not just manage, but to effectively lead.
Yeah, you know, I find in my experience that it's that senior executive leadership does not communicate very well down the line as to, you know, what is important and what's not important, what the company's going to be in, like, you know, 3 or 5 years.
Right.
And it's hard to align to something that you don't know what that something is.
Oh, 100%. And because the participation of the majority of people in an organization is critical for successful transformation, that's one of the most important pieces. And I write about this. It permeates the entire book, but I write it. There's a couple chapters specifically about defining a very clear and concise vision and mission narrative that people can clearly articulate. They can share that story. They can envision what winning looks like. So they know, to your point, what are we going to look like as an organization on the other side of this transformation? Yeah. Because all transformations are designed to be a positive thing, you know, better speed, better efficiency, better customer service, better products, happier employees, happy shareholders, what have you. Yet most organizations fail at really communicating that powerful vision early, often, and always throughout the process. One of the biggest challenges that leaders face is we under-communicate the vision. We drop it, you know, we drop a few lines on a slide in a, you know, monthly company meeting or a quarterly company meeting. Something goes out in a newsletter. Some people at the very top can kind of articulate that vision. Then you go a couple rungs below and they're kind of like, yeah, it has something to do with, you know, innovation or improving customer service, but not really sure how we're going to do that. So, and as you get deeper and deeper, to your point earlier, some people don't even know anything about the transformation, much less how it's going to happen, what are the priorities, and how they as an individual can help drive that mission forward. And one of the other challenges that leaders face and the mistakes that we make is we pile a whole big new list of competing priorities on top of the workforce's already important day-to-day job functions, and therefore we burn them out immediately, and they don't know which priorities are the real priorities, because we tell them, here are the new priorities. They're all number one priorities. And you also, you're getting measured on these other things that you've already been doing for months or weeks or years. So yeah, nobody really knows what the hell's going on.
Yeah. And I find, you know, most companies, or many of the largest, of course, companies in the world are multinational. And I find that senior execs sometimes speak of the corporate vision in MBA words oriented towards Wall Street, rather than the people that are going to make it happen, you know, in the simplest terms, where English might not even be the primary language, might not even be a secondary language.
No, 100%. We throw out those you know, business school buzzwords, and you know, have, you know, put all these great, sometimes even spend thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars on new branding materials and new vision statements and culture statements, and sometimes the outcome of that is that people don't really connect with it. It's not real. They don't understand, okay, how is, that's great, sounds fancy, but how can I, as Mr. Frontline Manager or whoever, how can I actually affect change? How can I help lead that change? What does that all really mean in the day-to-day and how we're actually going to execute this?
Yeah, so let me ask you, you know, and of course you could only probably share what you can share, but, you know, when you're working on operations in Iraq, you no doubt had to work side by side with Iraqis on occasion. Would that be correct?
We did later on my first tour in 2003. And I know where you're going with this, so I'm drawing a similar correlation. We actually worked more closely side by side, literally living and fighting alongside the Polish Grom. They're the Polish's tier one special operations unit. And there were a lot of cultural, behavioral, structural barriers that we had to overcome, and not to mention communication barriers, because only the officers spoke English. Right. So we had to literally, all very similar trained and similar cultures, so to speak, when it comes to special operations and how we operate, how we work. But there were obviously some significant challenges. My SEAL task unit was the first task unit operating in and around Baghdad, Ramadi, and Fallujah, and we got there in April of 2003. So we were essentially testing, if not rewriting, the book on capture or kill missions and close quarters combat, because up to that point, none of us had done it in a real theater of war before, much less working alongside foreign allied forces with certain communication barriers. And then, of course, there's a lot of moving parts, a lot of deconfliction with other conventional forces in the area. And that's why we're trained so well to lead and adapt and communicate in very shifting, dynamic, chaotic situations.
So let's talk about that, because I think, you know, I think that's a very important point. You know, I think that in the 20th century company, you know, process excellence was most important. But I think the 21st century company, the biggest enemy is facing company is time. Right. You know, so how is a company, a small, compact, you know, SEAL team is not a, you know, 50,000 or 20,000 employee company. You know, how do, companies help ready themselves to assess the situation and devise and deploy a decisive response to that situation. I mean, the SEAL team is trained for this. You know, how can that translate to a company?
Well, it's I'm really glad you made that that correlation from 20th century to 21st century, because I actually write about that a lot in the book. And one simple correlation that I can make is, if you think about it, in the military in its entirety, but more specifically in the special operations community, we entered these conflicts after 9/11 essentially as a very slow moving, process oriented, very vertically and horizontally siloed 20th century organization. And we quickly realized that to adapt and to move at the speed these wars required, we had to really start redesigning our structures, our systems, our processes, our internal and external communication strategies, to really build a more nimble and agile approach to the battlefield, because we're fighting a very decentralized enemy. And therefore, one of the main aspects of our transformation as a military is to become a bit more decentralized in our leadership mechanisms, our decision-making controls, just like a lot of 21st century organizations that are thriving are doing the same thing. We're starting to, one of the ways, to your point, to sort of build that resilience and readiness into an organization, and you have to do it carefully and, you know, with a very specific approach. It can't just be, you can't just slap new structures on and hope it works.
Right.
But a lot of what we're doing, and the companies that are more taking that more agile approach, of course, are, like we've done in special operations, is to not necessarily replace, but in for lack of a better term, replace sort of the old hierarchies and old top-down process, the old command and control culture, with networks and ecosystems of more authentically empowered leaders and teams that have a bit more autonomy for on the quote-unquote battlefield, so to speak, to make decisions, move more quickly. But the key there, and I've seen organizations fail at this, the key is you have to have the right people with the right training and the right resources to be able to execute. If you try and create a more agile environment, and you know, you guys are going to be empowered with these decisions and these decisions, but then you don't give them any training, you don't give them any resources, then you're just really setting them up to fail, and this organization is going to be worse off than it was before and more disorganized.
Right,
a lot
right.
of organizations are over complicating that process to agree. You still have hierarchies, but you're sort of overlaying more nimble networks of people that have the resources, the tools, and the skill set and the training to be able to execute. Just like in special operations, we wouldn't be able to be a more nimble and agile fighting force if we didn't have the best training in the world, if we didn't have access to the best intelligence in the world, if we didn't have access to you know, to resources to actually, again, move at the speed these wars required to fight and defeat a more decentralized enemy. It just wouldn't work. And the same thing in today's 21st century business environment. Organizations that are thriving are successfully restructuring themselves. But there's a lot of, and I touch on this in the book, there's a lot of cultural implications there as well. If you don't match the culture with that strategy and transform your culture along with the business, you're going to have some major disconnects in mindset and approach that don't align with that new structure.
So you obviously feel strongly about using a culture-driven approach to business transformation and leading through change. Doesn't that have a prerequisite that there has to be an existing culture willing to embrace this?
Absolutely. And that's where a lot of organizations, I believe, fall short, is because, and there's a lot of data and research about how this happens and some case studies in the book, but we often, and I've made this mistake in the past, where we realize, you know, the business is being threatened, or maybe we're not growing as quickly as we were before, or the competitive landscape is more aggressive than it was, you know, 2 years ago. My companies were technology-based companies, so rapidly growing companies, but even in more rapidly growing industries. So again, you're being forced to try and change and adapt, but oftentimes we start on step 5 or 6 when we should be starting on step 1 of transformation. And in large part, that's looking at those foundational pieces like culture, like the engagement of the team. Do we have a team that has the mindset and the skill set and a culture that aligns with becoming what we want to become. And there's ways that you can do that, but when you can work backwards from design, basically defining what is that desired result. Okay, we're going to transform based on the data. Here's who we need to become to succeed and thrive. Okay, great. Well, then one step below that is, what are the actions that everybody, you know, in perfect world, everybody in the organization needs to proactively take and have the skill set to do so to drive that result? And one step below that is, okay, well, what are the beliefs, especially that the leaders and managers need to behold? So what is the mission that I need to believe in deeply and passionately so that it can permeate the entire organization? So when I tell that story and define that vision, people can get behind that mission narrative and emotionally connect to it. And then, of course, over time, more and more people will believe in the mission. You're always going to have your naysayers and the people that will stand in the way of change. And there's ways that you can mitigate that and deal with that as well. But, and the sort of the bottom rung of that process is, what are the cultural experiences we need to have in this organization to ultimately achieve that desired result, the end result of the vision fulfillment of that transformation? So we oftentimes skip the foundational pieces of culture and engagement and kind of auditing that as it exists today. Do we have the right culture? Let's say, for example, in one of my companies, we were basically being forced to change. We were growing rapidly, all good problems, but at the same time, to keep pace with the changing environment, with the competition, we really needed to be a lot more innovative in the way we delivered truly integrated marketing solutions for our clients. And therefore, innovation was one of those desired results. That is one of the pieces of where we could say, yes, we are now a more innovative organization because we're the actions to take that, or we need to make better use of true collaboration and cross-functional teams. And therefore, the belief that we need to behold, and me as the leader first, is that innovation is the path to growth and profitability and shareholder value. And of course, better products and services for the customer. And therefore, some of those cultural experiences and rituals that really needed to be instituted in the organization to drive that belief started with talent acquisition programs to professional development strategies that aligned with that talent acquisition strategy, that aligned with creating a more innovative culture, and also even instituting things like what we called Innovation Lab and other opportunities where people could get out of their day-to-day and get out of their department or their division and collaborate with people from other areas of the organization, regardless of rank or subject matter expertise, and collaborate on how we could deliver more innovative, integrated solutions for those customers, or how we can create better speed and efficiency and quality within the business. So you're really giving the team the opportunity to have these rituals that instill that belief that innovation is the result. That's just an example of how you can really align culture with a business transformation desired result.
Now, we've talked a lot about culture, and I'm going to say the rollout, the execution phase, doing things, okay? You know, but what about, you know, planning and preparation? I mean, I think it was Benjamin Franklin, you know, he's always accredited with so much, but he's, I believe he said, you know, fail to plan, plan to fail. Yep. So, you know, obviously, you just don't go into action and you just don't, you know, start executing on your program and say, I'm going to change the culture today. I mean, what, you know, before you hit that launch button, before you hit, you know, say go, you know, how important is planning and preparation up front?
Oh, it's critically important. And like I said before, you're absolutely right. We oftentimes, we hit the go button. We start on step 4 or 5.
Yeah.
without actually taking a breath and making sure we have the right plan, the right contingencies. But more importantly, there's one of my favorite sayings in the teams is don't run to your death. Meaning when you're on an enemy target, take it slow, assess risk, and use speed and aggression when necessary. And that's actually a sort of a tactic transformation that we've gone to, where we used to hit targets with a bit more speed, a bit more aggression, and then your enemies learn those tactics. So the saying is don't run to your death, meaning slow it down and do it right. But another one of my favorite quotes from a German field marshal from World War I is, no plan survives first contact with the enemy. Yes. So we can plan, we can have the contingencies, but if we're not prepared to adapt, to fall back on those plans, we don't have the skill set, the resources, the tools at our disposal, or that even that appropriate mindset, then the plan and all your contingencies don't really matter. So imagine sending a group of untrained BUD students from the early SEAL pipeline with a great plan, awesome contingencies, onto a very dynamic enemy target with you know, little to no intel. They have a great plan, but they're still not going to know what to do. They're not going to be able to adapt fast enough, even if they have the best intentions in the world. Right. So planning and preparation are equally as important. But without preparation, without the skills and the training and the resources to execute those plans and or adapt and fall back onto one of your many contingencies, it's all going to be pretty irrelevant. And the same thing applies in today's more disruptive and fast-paced business environment for all types of organizations is that, you know, back in the day, especially as a young entrepreneur, you have these 5-year business plans and they're, you know, they're very rigid and people just don't even do that anymore. I believe in the 1-page business plan and that's going to change a lot, you know, over the course of quarter to quarter as you flow through the year. So,
Right. Well, let's take a break for sponsors' input and we'll come back in a moment.
Great.
This episode of State of Readiness, sponsored by Zonatech Consulting Group International, an operations management and consultancy firm serving companies and organizations from around the world. Our offerings include strategic advisory on business operations, technology, business transformation, international expansions, and building a culture of leadership. We also specialize in helping companies architect and deploy their continuous improvement and operational excellence programs. Learn more at www.zonatech.com. Welcome back. This is Joseph Paris, State of Readiness, and with me I've got Brent Gleason. How are you doing again? Brent, still with us?
I'm doing great. I'm still here.
All right. So you've written your book, Talking Point, great title, or Taking Point, sorry, Taking Point, great title. And what caused you to write a book?
It was a culmination of many things. I sold my last business almost 2 years ago, but I'd been building the speaking and leadership management and business transformation consulting practice for the last 6 years, and I've spoken all over the world, focused in large part on leadership in the 21st century and culture transformation and improving culture so that you can align it with your strategic objectives, and been researching it and writing about it in my Forbes and Inc. columns. But it really came to a point where I wanted to kind of throw all my chips on the table, go all in, and really focus on putting all this into a book. And I love the topics around change management, although I don't like the term change management because I really think that it kind of throws you, it only gets you 50% there, because it changed today in the 21st century needs to be truly led and evangelized from as many areas in an organization as possible. And there's management is only a piece of that. And I love authors like John Cotter and some of these other great books out there that are really, and Marshall Goldsmith and a lot of the books that I reference in my own book. And I've seen those principles enacted in other organizations, and I've succeeded and failed at some of the implementation of those in my own organizations through business transformation. And that aligned with my experiences in the military and our vast ongoing transformation in our post 9/11 reality. There's just a lot of correlations you can draw between, our military and the environment we're in today and the 21st century business environment. There's a lot of organizations out there right now continuing to crave some of those learnings and understand, well, how can we enact some of these principles and values and approaches to building high performance cultures in our organization so that we can be more agile, so we can build a truly resilient organization that bounces back from adversity, that has a little bit of healthy paranoia and is always looking to the landscape for threats and opportunities, just like we do, obviously, in the military. So it came to a point where I said, hey, I really need to put this into a book. And by the grace of God, I found a lit agent that believed in the project, and he took it to 4 major publishers in one day. And at the end of that afternoon, all 4 wanted the book. I almost fell over.
Awesome. Now, how long did it take you from the moment you said, I'm going to write a book, to the moment it was on the shelf? How long did that take?
About a year, which is actually for a book like this is pretty fast. I believe, if I'm thinking correctly, we signed the deal in February of 2017 with Simon & Schuster, and then during the bulk of that year is when I was writing it, and I think They told me I wasn't allowed to touch the manuscript anymore sometime around August. And then there was some, you know, some editing going on August and September. And then it published, and then it went through the, you know, the typical process. And then it published in February of this year.
Super. Now, you know, obviously, what was the motivation for you to join the service and then become a SEAL?
It's actually kind of a funny story. I grew up in Dallas, as you mentioned earlier. I went to Southern Methodist University for my undergrad education, and I got degrees in finance and economics, and just figured I never had any real aspirations of going into the military. Always somewhat fascinated by it, but keep in mind, this was just pre-9/11, so totally different implications at the time. But I did have two very close friends, one who was my roommate. We graduated. He went into the Navy to pursue a Navy intelligence career. He's had a phenomenal career in the military and government and other black areas of operation, we'll say. I also had a buddy who was a year behind me. So when I was working in finance, he was a senior, and he was one of these guys who wanted to be a SEAL his whole life. So that was his path. That's what he wanted to do. So I had two very close friends who were going to serve the country in a very high capacity. And so while I was working in finance, I started training with my buddy who was a senior. And because I had been a college athlete, I played rugby in college, and it was a way for me to stay fit and help him prepare for a rough journey. But we started spending so much time together and having more and more dialogue about the SEAL teams and the history of the Naval Special Warfare community and its culture and the implications of what it means to be part of that type of an elite organization. And I read a couple books, and then I read a couple more books, and quickly I became enthralled with the concept, with the culture, with the challenge. Back then, you know, we kind of joke in the community that, you know, pre-9/11 it was more of a PT challenge or a physical training challenge. Can I become a SEAL physically? Do I have the mental fortitude? Now, of course, it's I want to serve my country in the highest possible capacity to defend our nation against our enemies. That's why I have such a deep respect for, I mentor guys now into the program and have such a deep respect for those who know they're going to war. Back then, we didn't really know. It was, being a SEAL was, you know, you're in one of the most elite fighting forces, but it was kind of standby to standby. There wasn't a whole lot going on. Right. So long story short, I worked for about a year. We trained, then I quit my job. We moved up to Crested Butte, Colorado to train for 6 more months at high altitude, and then joined the Navy, and luckily made it through the pipeline. And 9/11 was actually a couple days before my class started the advanced portion of the SEAL selection process. So that was sort of an instantaneous transformation of mindset, of culture, of structure in the special operations community and the military and, well, I guess the world. Everybody was impacted by that day, but especially people in the armed services, because now it was game on.
Right. So you're married, you have a wife and three kids.
I do.
When and where did you meet your wife?
We actually met at a wedding in Costa Rica. So another kind of funny story. It's funny how the world works, but my wife grew up with her best friend from Newport Beach. They're from Orange County. Ended up marrying one of my best, her friend married one of my best SEAL team buddies. So two girls from Orange County ended up marrying two SEALs from Texas. I don't know where they went wrong or what happened, but some wires got crossed and now they're stuck. But no, it was actually funny too, because I had another one of my buddies from college had a wedding that weekend. He was a good friend of mine, and even my parents were invited to that wedding in Houston, Texas. And I was like, well, you know, wedding in Houston, wedding in Costa Rica. Let's just say I chose Costa Rica. And thank God I did, because I met my wife that first night when I arrived. And 2 days later, I told her that we were going to get married. So I figured that was going to do one of two things. It was either going to scare the crap out of her and send her running for the hills, or intrigue her. So here we are.
So after 2 days, you said you were going to marry her, and she didn't run. No. And then when did you get married?
Then we got married. We got engaged 3 months after that. So we basically 3 months after knowing each other, we got engaged. And then a week after that, we actually got married. But then we had the big wedding the following summer.
Okay, so just so you know, from the moment I met my wife until the day we got married was 8 weeks and a day. So
Yeah,
I
there you
got you. I got you
go.
by a nose there. So
It works out every now and then, thank God.
but it comes down to, I think it might be in both of our natures is to synthesize a decision from imperfect data.
Yep, 100%.
And then we just work it. You know what I mean? How can you possibly know your wife after 3 months or 6 months? How can I know mine after 8 weeks? You know what I mean? But,
Exactly.
and of course both partners have to, be similarly inclined. And I think the same is true in businesses. You have to build that trust. You have to build that,
Oh, yeah.
cadence, that repertoire, understand that everybody's going to make a mistake, but then just work through the mistake.
Yeah, I agree. And I just think that, I think somewhere along the line, the sanctity of marriage has hit a snag where people don't fall back on those basics of, like, to your point of trust and working through those problems, working through the mistakes. And by no means is, is it hunky dory every single day, especially once you throw young kids in the mix and, companies and work and travel. But I mean, you know the drill. So it, but it's work. And she's my new commanding officer. It's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, happy wife, happy life.
Yeah, 100%.
So, were you still active when you got married?
No, I was out. I had already gone to grad school and was just, working in one of the businesses I'd started, so.
Okay. So, when you were out in the field, no doubt you must have got lonely, and I understand that you became a companion with a monkey in Africa.
Old Iron Mike. Yes, I write about this in the chapter about resiliency, just as kind of a funny angle of looking at resilience. But yeah, one day I was out on a jog and on this, we'll use the term naval base very loosely, on the coast of Kenya. But this is more of a camp. But I was out on a jog through the trails along the coast and came across, unfortunately, the his mother and his and he and his brother were infants, essentially. I mean, both of them would fit in the palm of my hand. And she had been hit, looked like she'd been probably hit by a Jeep or something, but they were still alive. So I picked them both up and ran them back to the camp and nursed them back to health. Unfortunately, his brother didn't survive, but he survived, and I raised him for 6 months, and he'd sleep in my rack with me, and in the mornings he would just like our babies and toddlers do. In the morning he'd climb up onto my chin and grab my eyelashes and rip my eyes open and scream in my face and tell me it was
Did he at least bust your tray for you?
time to eat. No,
No,
unfortunately he didn't.
that's too bad.
We did
Oh well.
make a karate uniform for him,
Yeah.
though.
So, if you could recall, one of the moments, I don't know if you golf. I golf, and I don't. I'm not good. But when I hit that perfect shot. You know what I mean? You
Yep.
can't feel the ball connecting with the club, and it
Exactly.
just goes like a rocket. And for that moment, you say, "This is why I'm here." Out in the field, did you ever have a moment like that, or probably more than one, I would imagine, but any one stand out?
Well, I will admit that it's very rare on the golf course that I have that moment. So when it does happen, it's a very special thing.
I call my golf clubs weapons of grass reduction.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's more likely that I'm throwing a club as opposed to actually feeling that moment of satisfaction, watching it go straight down the fairway. But there's definitely multiple times, but in different ways, that you feel that connection to the mission, that connection to serving in that capacity. And it's not, I wouldn't say more so, it's not on a mission where, you go in, you got the bad guy, nobody got killed, nobody got hurt. Those are always great. But it's sometimes a deeper situation where things did go south and the plan didn't survive first contact with the enemy, but you worked together as a team and you still got out of it alive and nobody got hurt. Obviously, somebody asked me this the other day, and what is the what's the most, it's kind of an odd question to ask during Q&A after a keynote, but it was like, what's the hardest mission you've ever been on? And there's no singular answer to that, but my answer was that it's the missions that you don't bring everybody home. That's the hardest mission. it's not one specific mission, but it's a mission where, you know, you deploy back home and you're not deploying with everybody. And but it's the moments, it's sort of those micro moments throughout these different, you know, deployments to different theaters of war, where you remind yourself that you do believe in what you're doing. You're doing it for a greater cause. You're protecting those who can't protect themselves, and not just those of us back home, but the non-combatants on the battlefield, these people who were forced to live in war-torn countries their entire lives. They don't know any different. And we're trained not to always just enact aggression on a target, for example. I mean, sometimes, you know, there's situations where 1 minute you're in a gunfight, 30 seconds later you're carrying toddlers and young kids across the room so they don't cut their feet on the broken glass from the explosive breach. You know, it's you have to be a humane and empathetic warrior oftentimes, and, you know, on the modern battlefield, and learn, you know, when to dial up the intensity, when to dial it down, and understanding, you know, what matters. So it's I know that's sort of a circuitous way of answering that question, but there's multiple different micro moments where you say, yeah, you know, this is why I do what I do, and this is why I believe in this mission.
Yeah. So some speed round questions, and then we'll go to wrap up here. Who's the one leader you look up to most, and why?
These questions are always difficult. I think that just based on the topic of today, one of the first that comes to mind is I have to look towards some of my, you know, our battlefield commanders, and not because they're, you know, they're hardened warriors necessarily, but because they're great leaders in many different capacities. Retired General Stanley McChrystal is one of them, and one of the reasons I really respect him as a leader. There's many, but when he was leading one of our most significant task forces during the most dynamic and shifting parts of this war, he's actually who I'm kind of referring to as a leader when I talk about the military and the special operations community's significant transformation. It was really he and his team were the catalyst of not just realizing the need for shift and transformation and culture, mindset, and approach to the battlefield, but also the people who implemented that transformation. And it's constant, it's dynamic, or it's, you know, it's still evolving. But that's one of the reasons, and we have a lot of very similar philosophies as how that applies to business transformation. His book, Team of Teams, very aligned with my philosophies. Their follow-on book that was written by one of his partners, Chris Fussell, who's a retired SEAL. Their book, One Mission, also very aligned with the philosophies in Taking Point. So just a lot of respect and a lot of similar approach to military, to business. So a lot of respect there.
So what's the best piece of advice you've ever received?
I think there's a lot of different advice, but one that kind of comes to mind, and this wasn't necessarily how it was given to me, but I can correlate this back to one of our SEAL philosophies, is the phrase, and we've got many phrases. I'll just put that out there. We have a lot of sayings, a lot of phrases, but one of them is to get comfortable being uncomfortable. And the philosophy and how that relates to life, to business, to marriage, to parenting is, I really believe in the concept of finding an opportunity, if not every day, to push yourself a little bit beyond your comfort zone. Push the boundaries of your comfort zone a little bit, whether it be in, you know, a business decision-making process, or your how you communicate with your spouse or a coworker or a peer, or how you deal with your children, and pushing those confines a little bit every day. Or as my a guy I graduated and served with, this guy named David Goggins. He's also now not just a retired SEAL, but a world-renowned ultra athlete, an extreme athlete, ultra marathon runner. And he puts it in a simpler term. He says, do something that sucks every day. meaning, push yourself outside your comfort zone every chance you get, because the more you do, the wider that area becomes. And I've seen that time and time again in my life. When you take a little bit of calculated risk based on, you know, sometimes good, sometimes very minimal data. and then you, like you said, according to marriage, then you kind of work the issue, you change, you adapt, and you figure it out. But every time I've taken calculated risk in my life, from leaving my finance job to join the Navy, which of course the SEAL program, very, very high attrition rate, huge risk, but it changed my life. And then serving in that capacity, and then deciding to become an entrepreneur, similar attrition rate to SEAL training. You know, it's about 80 or 90% will, you know, businesses will, won't reach their potential, will just fail. So I really believe in that. Get comfortable, be uncomfortable. And if you, you push yourself a little bit about out those boundaries, that's, it's, if you looked at sort of a line graph, it's not inside that bubble of where your comfort zone would be shaded in green. It's outside of that comfort zone is where the magic happens.
Yeah. Yeah. And I heard that just recently. I was at a tour at Walt Disney and World or Land, whichever one's in Florida there. Yeah. And that's what they said too. Interesting.
Oh,
so your book, Taking Point. Now, you signed with Simon Schuster, but I understand that some of the proceeds are going to some projects, pet
yes.
projects of yours. Could you tell me a little bit about them?
So, yeah, one of the things that my family is, believes in wholeheartedly is giving back and philanthropy. And, you know, you see a lot of, out in the charity world and the philanthropy world, and a lot of times people are doing it more for a social recognition type of thing. But the two charities we support that are very close to our heart, one is March of Dimes, because our middle child, Parker Rose, who's now four, she had a bit of a birth defect when she was born. She's fine now, but, you know, had two serious surgeries and you know, before she was 1 year old. And so that's a we're an ambassador family for March of Dimes. But I'm also on the executive board of the SEAL Family Foundation. And we, of course, support the our core mission is family resilience within the NSW community. So we, of course, support the families of our active duty and, of course, the fallen operators. And we have a lot of very specific programs, you know, medical care. We pay for, unfortunately, we pay for memorial services and funeral and travel. But we also pay for college scholarships and other different types of programs. And a lot of these programs are also focused on family resilience in lowering the divorce rate and providing more resources to spouses, especially when their, you know, their husband is deployed. So one of the things I wanted to do, and that's kind of how I continue to serve, is to serve on the board. We've raised millions of dollars over the past few years for NSW families, and I wanted a portion of the proceeds of the book to go to that cause as well.
Super. That's outstanding. So if our audience wanted to get in touch with you.
Sure. My current website is just brentgleasonspeaker.com. And my Twitter handle is just at Brent Gleason. And those are the best ways to follow me, to track what's going on. And there's information about, you know, speaking engagements and the book and things like that on the website.
So that how do you spell that out for the audience that might not know how to spell?
Sure. That'd be BrentGleason, speaker.com.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure having you on this first episode of State of Readiness. I appreciate the time that you've taken out of your busy schedule to join me today, Brent, and much success to you in all of your endeavors and also in Taking Point.
Well, it was an honor, and I had a blast, and it was great to be on the first episode.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to State of Readiness. You can discover more episodes and learn about the book written by Joseph Paris of the same title at www.state-of-readiness.com. You can learn more about Joseph Paris at www.josephparis.me/card.